All right. And now we're going to hand it over to Tab and Jeff, who are going to share with us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you. So I'm going to tell you a little story first. We were recently had a family gathering, and we've now entered the stage of four generations of family gathering celebrations, as our daughter and her husband have now had a child, and we're getting to experience this cycle all over again. And at our last family gathering, we all got talking after a little bit of dinner, having some good times together, and then one of my siblings brings up a big question. They say, you know, when do you think life begins? And we all kind of look at each other, thinking about our responses. And so one of my siblings said, well, I think it begins at conception. Makes sense. Pretty good answer. And we got a doctor in the house back here. He can maybe give some answers. Another one of my siblings says, no. Life begins at birth. When the baby comes out, then it's life. Well, that didn't sit well with one of my other siblings. And they went, nope, I've researched this one. I know the answer. It begins at 12 weeks. Because 12 weeks is when you have a functioning heart. And that's life. Oh, we're all contemplating looking at that. My dad got up and he goes, you're all wrong. Every one of you is wrong. Life began when the last one of you moved out and took your dog with you. We love family, don't we? Don't we? It is good. Family is to celebrate. We're in a season of celebration where we celebrate each other. We're going to be gathering with family a lot in the next week and maybe 2 weeks. And as we gather with our children and our families, it's a little reflective now. As we get to kind of experience with this new, our first grandchild coming through, it's emotional. We're getting to see things a second time. And when you get to go through things a second time, it's like a second opportunity to kind of do the things that you couldn't do the first time. Because when you go through it the first time, you make a lot of mistakes. Hey, nobody's perfect. We're all human, and there's grace for that. But the second time you go through, you experience something very different. And it got us thinking that there's these stages to life. And I'm going to read each of these stages to you. As the images show, the first stage here is pregnancy. And we're going to just be reflective from two points of view. The first point of view is from the infant. From their point of view, what are they experiencing? What are they seeing? What are they understanding? And then from the parent or the nurturer, from their point of view, what are they experiencing? What are they seeing? So there's six stages. The first one, image making, pregnancy. This stage, the baby's new, with no knowledge. The baby is 100% reliant upon their parents. The parents, meanwhile, they're preparing for this new arrival. Life is about to change.
They start making room for the life that is growing and coming into their house. Maybe a place for the baby to sleep, a room of its own, or even in their own space, or maybe even in their own bed. There's so many different ways that the nurturer chooses to nurture the one needing to be nurtured. So in this first stage, it is about making space.
And in this space, they will be imperfect. They will make mistakes, and that's okay. So getting into stage two here, the nurturing stage. So this is generally from zero to somewhere. We're going to call it 2 years for the sake of the argument. And this is the bonding, adjusting, and balancing stage, where babies, they're mostly still reliant upon their parents. And from a developmental point of view, these are the most influential years of their existence, where it's the filter of how you see life. How you're treated in those initial stages, you will have that filter on for the rest of your life. While the parents, this is where they get to form their first bonds of attachment. They learn to balance the needs of the baby. They also have to balance the needs of their partner in their relationship. the needs of their workplace that's so demanding. This was greatly difficult for me, and probably part of the mistakes a lot of us men make in these initial stages. Well, we try and work. We're working. We're providing. Mums are nurturing. And I thought that, which is not true at these initial stages. And we'll kind of break this down as we get into this. The next stage is authoritarian, okay, ages 2 to 5. And this is when the child is getting to learn the rules of the game, how things work in this life. It's a very black and white stage. These are the rules, these are your limits, and the parent is the one introducing. So your values, what you believe, what you think, gets all implied unto the children. It becomes part of an imprint into what they see as life as the rules of the game, the boundaries.
And this is often when the nurtured begin to discover mine, right? This is when they vocalize mine, don't touch, or how Joel used to do it. Anyone would come anywhere near and he'd put up his finger and he'd say, go.
Appropriate boundaries. The next stage here is interpretive. Interpretive, we'll call it from ages 5-ish in that range, plus or minus a year, and going into adolescence. So this is where you adapt, the children adapt to the changing environments around them. As we grow and leave the nest a little bit, they go to school, they get into their social groups, they're introduced into other people's boundaries, other people's perspectives, and what they were introduced as this is safe, this is right, this is my moral belief. And those are greatly different from family to family, and you get into these tension zones. And these tension zones, you got to figure out, well, how do I adapt to them? And how do they adapt to me? And we can do these things well. We can do these things very poorly. And we're going to talk about that. The parents in these stages should start teaching their children to take the perspectives of other people. Empathy, highly, highly important. And they want to be interpreting the behaviors of other people so that they can react accordingly. Our fifth stage, and we find ourselves as parents right now in between the fifth and sixth stage, so we're just kind of leaving this stage. Interdependency. We're going to call this adolescence before the departure, which is our sixth stage. And this is a freedom and maturity of the individual. It's a stage of great conflict. This is, a lot of us would say, these are those teenage years where our children are going out there and discovering for themselves independently, without our guidance, what is life going to look like for them. They're going to run into all those preset boundaries, and they're going to figure those things out on their own. But this stage is not fully independence because, see, the kids are going to mess up. They're going to make a lot of mistakes along the way. So we as parents, we're there to make that final say. We're that final stopgap. And as they...
Which doesn't always go over well. Right? You've encountered that tension. If you have raised a child, or if you watched your siblings, or even recall your own life, you can remember that stage where you wanted to do your own thing, and who cares about mom and dad's rules until you got caught. Then you realized, ooh, that hurt.
So effective and respectful communication is very, very important in this stage. As our children change and adapt, we too need to change and adapt to them. The whole way we parent, the way we communicate, the way we have relationship, all changes with our children. And our final stage, the departure stage, which was my dad joke at the beginning there. He loved it. That's when life begins. And it's the independence stage. This is where your children leave, and the signing of the independence is that they're able to make good decisions on their own without your influence. You don't need to be there. They're making good decisions now. They're independent of this. So as we look at each one of these stages here and see it from the perspective, a little bit from the children, a little bit from ourselves, these things are also, they sit in our spiritual growth. We have the same stages of growth with God. There has to be some point where you are born again. We often hear that term, born again. You're spiritually awakened to God. That's the pregnancy stage and the birthing stage. And as we move out into each one of these stages here, as we get into the nurturing stage, we're learning the rules. As you're a brand new Christian, what are the rules? What is this thing? And you learn a lot about Old Testament laws. Here's the boundaries. This is how you're supposed to relate to other human beings. The expectation here, and Jesus often brought this perspective, is when you sit there and look at the law and the rules, it can become very rigid, and it's the heart of the rule. It's what Jesus was expanding. There's a love inside these rules because they're for your benefit. They're for your good. And when you follow these things, you'll see that life goes well for you.
And when you transition from that authoritative stage, which is the third picture at the top, into, again, the interpretive stage, you're now 5 to 10 years old in your growth, roughly. What happens is you discover that there is another way that moves from that authoritative law, right, into the way of Christ, the way of love.
So part of the walk and the journey as we get and become into our teenage years is we start bump a lot into, well, how do I react with the things that I've learned of God, with the things of the rest of life? How do I operate my workspace environment? There is a place of great conflict, right? Not everybody is trying to do and live life well or seek God or even believe in God. A lot of them haven't even hit the pregnancy stage. And yet you're much further along in your journey with the Lord. And so you're in a conflict zone. It doesn't work in these stages. They're not going to believe what you believe. You have different boundaries, and that's okay. That's good. That's part of getting to know you, yourself. Having boundaries is absolutely critical to being successful and becoming to where we want to be, independent. Independent, making good decisions without the influence of our mentors. You know, or I don't need my pastor every 5 minutes. I don't need to call Tab or Scott or somebody. Those things are good. But we want to get to the point where it's not necessary, and that we then become what we are at this stage is what we're now grandparents. We want to grow spiritually to get to that same point where now we can help that next generation. We can give into them. We can guide them in our spiritual journey. So as we see these pictures up here, all of this is about relationship. And relationship is something that we all desire. Every one of us was created for relationship. In fact, the Bible talks about this right at the beginning. And God creates Adam in this perfect spot. He's got everything. He's fully provided for. There's no needs for anything, and yet something was missing. He was missing his Eve, and he needed something. God created that missing piece. Relationship is necessary for all of us. However, the bumps and bruises of life as we walk this life may change your perspective of how much I really need relationship.
And due to bumps and bruises, you can allow yourself to harden your heart and begin to push away people, build up walls and create distance. But the only problem with that is that we're not designed to live in that space that way. And therefore, something in us begins to shrink and shrivel. We pull in into a protective mode. Have you ever done any research on the human body when in fact it is experiencing the beginnings of hypothermia, the cold? Let's call that the bumps and bruises of relationship where you haven't felt loved or accepted, wanted or nurtured. And as a result, what the human body begins to do is it takes the blood and it kind of locks it off from the extremities. hands and feet are the first things that get cold. And as the temperature drops, the blood continues to move to the central core. You get to such a part of freezing, and the blood resonates around the heart to keep it alive. This is what happens when our bumps and our bruises along the way and the tension in relationship is not fostered, ministered to, or changed in perspective. We continue to push people away, right? Continue to push people away and build walls.
So we're going to bring this into one filter only because it's a complex topic.
Yep.
So we're going to stick with one measure that I want everybody to use, this one filter today. Okay? It is the element of selfishness. So it's going to be, are you selfless or are you selfish? And we're going to define that. So selfish, it's the lack of consideration for other people. Preoccupation with one's own pleasures, profits, or welfare. Selfish people put their own needs ahead of others. Selfish people lack empathy and compassion. So that's their view. That's how they see life. And every one of us can relate to this. Every one of us at some point in our life has been selfish. Probably selfish again today at some point. Selfishness leads to a problem. And this is the struggle. This is the struggle that we see. The Bible outlays it in a very nice analogy here. God is often described in Scripture as the parent, and his children, the church or Israel, is often described as his children. And so let's take that same lens, how we saw it at the beginning, the different stages, our spiritual growth, and we're going to see it through the lens of selfishness or selflessness. And we see in Isaiah that we got a problem where it says,
I tenderly nurtured children and made them great, but they have rebelled against me. It goes on to say, your whole head is sick and your heart and your will are weak and faint. You are corrupt from the bottom of your feet to the top of your head.
So we all get this. Every one of us, as the Bible says, has fallen short of his glory. What is the selfishness ultimately? I like how this is said. It's unhealthy self in need sin. There's an acronym for it, self in need, but it's unhealthy. There's a healthy one. We're talking about the unhealthy one. This specifically is, you innately, as Scripture says here, you know what's right inside your heart. And when you choose not to do what's right, that is sin. It's straightforward. We all have this natural motivation to do this stuff. We're born into it. We don't got to be taught how to sin. We do it really well. We're good at this stuff. We got to be taught the other stuff. Now, the motivation behind the sin.
So the motivation that's often found behind sin, or when we choose to draw back, is fear. We are often afraid of something, something out of our control, some need not being met. This is the motivator behind selfishness. It is a constant. We see it at the very, very beginning when Adam and Eve were just so in love with each other, walking in the garden with God, and then all of a sudden, you know, they put distance and hide from the Lord and shelter themselves. And what is Adam's response? I was afraid because I was naked. I was afraid. And so we need to recognize that when we encounter selfishness within ourselves or within others, there's generally an underlying fear of a need not being met.
It always distances. It always wants to separate you from other people. It did the same thing when Adam and Eve decided to do the only one thing that they didn't have to do in the garden and wanted to do the end result, separated, it distant. But there's a solution. Now let's talk about selflessness. Having little or no concern for oneself, especially with regards to money, fame, and position. Selfless people put others' needs ahead of themselves. And this is key. Selfless people are motivated by empathy and compassion. So what is empathy? Empathy is into you, I see. I am not going to see the world from my viewpoint, my experiences, from that filter that I was born with as a child, the way that I was raised. I'm actually going to stop that, and I'm going to try and empathize and see the world through your eyes. Selfless people are really, really good at this. We see the solution to selfishness, to being selfless, is love. It's all founded in love. The scriptures here, the Bible, it's a big book. And I can probably bet right now that not everybody in this room has read this thing. And I'm for sure can say that not everybody has read this thing and understood this thing fully. We only get it in part.
We do.
So it's a big thing, but God simplified it. Jesus made it really simple for us. I'm going to sum up this whole thing in two verses.
And Jesus replied, "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and the greatest commandment. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments."
This draws you in. It does the opposite of what we saw that fear does. Fear separates, it provides distance. When you love, what is this, right? You're drawing in. You're pulling together. You're unifying. And in that, the selflessness of that, I'm dying to myself and giving to somebody else something that they need. I might be uncomfortable right now. I may be upset because I gave my wife bed and breakfast and she hasn't given me bed and breakfast in 3 years. But
that's not true. He's making that up.
But I still choose to pull in and love her. Because see, that's, even though I may not have a need met, I know she's got needs. And so I'm going to draw into her and love her and pull close. I'm going to be selfless. So Jesus is this perfect example. Let's just take it from the definition. Jesus left perfection and became imperfection. He's God. But he put flesh on and was subjected to all the trials and tribulations that we have. Satan even tried to tempt him. If it wasn't something real, he wouldn't have tried it. There was a plausible victory, he thought. The flesh is weak. He was born in a stable of lower class society. God, really? Coming as in a manger, in a stable, in a cow trough? That's what he's put into? The Messiah? That's one of the things that have thrown a lot of the religious leaders right off the trail. How is that possible? He's supposed to be the king. He's supposed to get rid of the Romans. He didn't sin. The wages of sin is death, and yet he chose willingly to die to take our sin upon himself. If that is not selflessness, I don't know what it is. In all of this, his love is expansive. He's always being generous. There is no fear there. Generosity, right away, one of the things, is there enough? Do I hold back? When God is generous, there's no fear. It's just expansive. Always, he invites all. And he's waiting all of our responses to this. So let's see this through the lens of a few people here. Let's look at the Christmas story, as this is the season that we're in. And let's, from the lens only of selfishness and selfless, we're going to make this a little interactive. You'll love this, Catherine. Mary, Joseph, the shepherds, King Herod, and the wise men. Let's just quickly look at each one of them and each of their stories. Now, I do have kind of the response and the answers on here, but let's just look at this. So, Tab, could you just read Luke 1, 26 to 38?
In the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a village in Galilee, to a virgin named Mary. She was engaged to be married to a man named Joseph, descendant of King David. Gabriel appeared to her and said, "Greetings, favored woman, the Lord is with you." Confused and disturbed, Mary tried to think what the angel could mean. "Don't be afraid, Mary," the angel told her, "for you have found favor with God. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you will name him Jesus. He will be a very great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his ancestor David, and he will reign over Israel forever. His kingdom will never end." Mary asked the angel, "But how can this happen? I am a virgin." And the angel replied, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. So the baby to be born will be holy, and he will be called the Son of God. What's more, your relative Elizabeth has become pregnant in her old age. People used to say she was barren, but she has conceived a son and is now in her sixth month. For nothing is impossible with God." Mary responded, "I am the Lord's servant. May everything you have said about me come true." And then the angel left her.
Okay, very, very clean response. This is an easy one. We started out with the easiest one, and I'm looking for a little bit of interaction here. So Mary's response, "Virgin, I'm pregnant. What the heck? This has never happened in human history. Never happened again after this." And how does she respond? "I'm your servant. I accept what you say, God." So on the scale of selflessness, selfish, where's that fall? Like 100% selfless. This is the perfect response.
Considering that in that day and age and that time frame, and Mirella did a bang up job, was it last year or a couple Christmases ago, talking about this, the stigma attached to Mary's choice, right? It could very well have meant her death. As a result, she was a teenage girl, probably around 13 years old, and the stigma attached to that would have been devastating. So for her to choose to step out of fear and embrace the courage of love, to yield herself to the will of the Father, to host the Son of God, to make room for that in her life, means she may have had plans. How many of you guys have plans? Plans for yourself, plans for your kids. They're going off to college, maybe medical school, yada, yada, yada. And then your kid comes and says, "Whoa, I want to do this. I want to take a year off and I want to travel the world." No, 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 no. Right? And so we have plans. But God's plan is better. And it expands our capacity for purpose.
That is the perfect response. Me being a man, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have responded like that. I think I would have responded like our next character here, Joseph. Because Joseph was a little more maybe socially aware and selfish in the social awareness. You heard it this morning as when the Tenenins read the story of Joseph. And in Joseph's story, you find it in Matthew 1, 18 to 25, he instantly considered breaking up the engagement. If he considered breaking up the engagement, he wasn't saying, "Hey, this is good." I mean, if Tabitha came to me and said, "Hey, you know, we're engaged and this is before we've had children," and she goes, "Hey, but I'm pregnant and it's God," you know, I'd have a little problem with that. And Joseph had a little problem with that. He may or not have been aware of the scriptures and what it said in the prophecy, but prophecies are weird sometimes. They can be vague and hard to decipher. And when it hits home and in your family, you resist it. I would have resisted this. And it took an intervention to fix Joseph. He had to have a spiritual moment where an angel showed up and said, dude, this is God. This is me. This is happening. And you're part of the plan. You got to participate in the plan. It's funny how God does that sometimes when we step out of line. He gives us the spiritual intervention to pull us back into line. Right? I mean, just as one quick bunny trail, I remember a friend of mine, really upset, but a good man and a mentor, saying, I never have had any spiritual experience with God. Nothing. I've never had anything. No angels. Nothing. I'm like, you never needed it. You never stepped out of the plan. This guy is an awesome dude. He didn't need it. While me, on the other hand, I needed it. I stepped out of line a bunch of times and needed that. So it's interesting how God moves. On the selfish meter, where would you put Joseph?
He got to selfless. And in Isaiah, it talks about if you have a willing heart. And he was willing to change his perspective based on the revelation that he was granted. If you have a willing heart.
That's the thing, is it's the response and how do you respond to something. So he may not had the knowledge in the moment going in, and he was going to do something, but he was righteous. He was described as righteous. But it's what he did next. Mary was a virgin. This is the angel's proclamation. So what does it say? The scripture says right at the end that was read, she remained a virgin until Jesus was born. He could have been selfish. He could have said, that's my husband's right. But he didn't. He honored it. So he took it selfless. He went way to the selfless side. I really respect him. He's a good man. All right. Our next one, the shepherds. This is a neat story. It's a long read, so I'll just summarize it as we're going to go into two more people here. So the shepherds are just hanging out. No intro into what they were doing. And an angel shows up and starts proclaiming and worshiping and singing about the birth of Jesus. Their response was instant worship. They joined in with the angels, and it says that all the armies of heaven were there. That's when I reread that, I'm like, oh, I forgot about that one. The armies of heaven were all worshiping together. And what did they do? They immediately sought out the child, found Jesus, and then they told everybody about the story. And it says, and they went back to their fields worshiping.
Let me read it for you. When the choir of angels disappeared, and I'm reading it up the Passion Translation, and returned to heaven, the shepherds said to one another, let's go, let's hurry and find this word who is born in Bethlehem and see for ourselves what the Lord has revealed to us. So they hurried off and found their way to Mary and Joseph. And there was the baby lying in a feeding trough. Upon seeing this miraculous sign, the shepherds recounted what had just happened. Everyone who heard the shepherd's story was astonished by what they were told, but Mary treasured all of these things in her heart and often pondered what they meant. The shepherds returned to their flocks, ecstatic over what had happened. They praised God and glorified him for all they had heard and seen for themselves, just as the angel has said.
Response, selfish meter. What do you guys think? Like it's like a Mary's response. It's a perfect response. There's nothing wrong with it. They reacted perfectly. And so let's just recap those three before we get into our next character. Mary, Joseph, shepherds. When you think of them, happy thought, bad thought. Right.
Warm fuzzies.
They're good. They're good. And what did they do? The response was selfless. Watch the feeling and what you think of the next character. Because this does something to every one of us. The selfish individual. King Herod. King Herod, a little preamble just so we get this guy's position. Because empathy is required if we're to understand anybody. So, King Herod's in a pickle. King Herod he's an Edomite. He's not even Jewish. And he has been put as king over Israel by Rome. Rome at this time has conquered from Israel west. All the way west, they're going north at this point in history. East of them is the Parthian Empire. They have no control and are at war with the Parthians. The Parthians are massive. They took over the Eastern Greek Empire. And the Parthians and the Romans are fighting over Armenia at the time. And what's right underneath Armenia is Israel. Okay, so when you see in scripture and you see the first thing is when these wise men from the east, they're Parthians, when they come in, Herod is freaked out. And not just Herod, but all Bethlehem with him.
Jerusalem.
Because they're declaring a new king is born. That's a scary thing from your enemies, religious leaders. They were satraps and magi. They were both religious leaders and political leaders. They combined the two in that nation. And they're coming declaring a new king. That's almost a message for war.
They were also considered the kingmakers because they were both holding a government perspective and a religious perspective. And so whatever they declared someone to be king in the Parthian Empire, that's the person that was established. And all of that region would have known this. So when they come into Israel, not only are they at war with the Romans, and Herod is, you know, set up as king by the Romans, not even a Jew, but here they come declaring, where is the king of the Jews?
So yeah, so that gives you a little more empathy, right? Understanding from his point of view, because how and what did Herod do? The wise men come in and say, hey, where's this king? He's freaked out. What does he do? He calls the priests and his religious leaders and says, find in the scriptures, tell me what's going on. And they come back to him and said, the king's going to be born in Bethlehem, the Messiah. So this is a very real thing to him. And what is his reaction? He calls a private meeting with the wise men and says, hey, go find him, worship him, and then tell me where he is so I can go and worship with you. Thing is, this guy was acting selfishly. He wasn't telling them what was really going on. The wise men go down there. They meet Jesus. What happens to Herod, though, is when the wise men don't return to him, he's furious. And what does he do? He sends his army and kills every baby 2 years and under. Friend, that's the time they sell the star. He wanted to make sure that no matter what, he wiped this king out. He was fully selfish. He was taking the lives of other people to preserve a kingdom that he thought was threatened by a baby child being supplanted by their enemies in the east. So, selfish meter? Like, it's horrible. And how does it make you feel? Do you like him? Right, he's disgusting. He's I do not aspire to be King Herod, right? And that's the connection piece. Every time we are selfish, we are letting other people feel that about us. When we're selfish and taking and hoarding, you're King Herod. All right. Now this is the best. This is my favorite response. The wise men, the same story, King Herod. Now a little bit of preamble is necessary for empathy. And the wise men, the storyline is they were already searching. They were already prepared. They went looking, saw a star. We were talking about this yesterday. I'm like, what the heck? How can it be a star? Like a star, it stops on top of a house. When I look at the stars that are up there, I can't tell if it's shining light on that house or Scott's house or this house. To me, it makes no sense to me. I think it's an angel because it's moving. But whatever it is, it's just conjecture. The end of the day, they were prepared. They went. And when they came to Christ, they come out and look what we got. Gold, incense, frankincense. They came with gifts prepared. Gifts of royalty. They're all prophetic signs. These guys had foreknowledge. They were mature. They were higher up in the developmental stage. I highly, highly respect that. Let me give you one little nugget as to why they were prepared. These magi from the east, they were descendants from the rulership of Daniel. Daniel was the second in charge of two global empires, both of the Babylonians and the Persians. He was the second in charge. What he said mattered. When you go today, they have temples to Daniel in Muslim lands. He was a Hebrew. They have issues, right? And yet it's still there to this day. Very revered. Daniel was the head of the satraps and the magicians and all they said. That's their religious leaders. They held on to the religious thought. There's one story in Daniel 9:24. An angel shows up and says, there's 77s for you and your people. This is specific to the Jewish people. Split into two things, 69 and one. And these things are weeks of years. So what that means is if you take 69 times 7 and you multiply that by a year, which is the Julian calendar started in 54 BC. The Gregorian calendar started in 1582, I believe. Those are 365-day calendars. The ones before that, all nine of them, they're all 360-day calendars. The Chinese, the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Iraqi Mesopotamians, and the Hebrew people. So at the time when the angel said this, there were 360 days. If you multiply those numbers, you get 183,000 something days. This is unbelievable. So the angel says, from the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the King comes, there will be these 69 weeks, 183,000 something days. The decree was issued by Artaxerxes in 445 BC, March something. I have the dates in here. If you run the 183,000 plus days, you get to April 6, 32 AD. April 6, 32 AD, you can go back multiple different sources and find out that's the exact day that Jesus came in for Easter.
Riding on a donkey.
The Messiah was revealed on the very day. The very day, the angel said. It's freaking awesome.
The wise men.
Sorry. So,
the wise
I recovered.
Men, yeah, wait a second. The wise men knew because they were, Daniel had mentored them, discipled them, grew them up past their religious understanding into what God's understanding was about time and space and purpose and nations. And as a result, they were prepared to recognize the sign. And this was the very thing that Jesus held against the people of that day and age, the religious leaders, who also had the same words of Daniel and should have recognized the signs of the time. They should have known. And as a result, because they didn't know to recognize the sign of the time and required a sign of God to prove that he was who he was, he said, you wicked generation, because of your unbelief, you already had everything. I provided it all for you. It was all there.
See, his people didn't know the time, and yet the people that weren't considered his own knew the time. They came prepared.
And one of the differences is that they were still functioning, they, his people, under the system of the law, losing sight of the essence of the law. They didn't flow into mercy. They didn't uphold justice and righteousness. And upholding justice is not a measure of right and wrong. Upholding justice means that you defend the weak, the destitute, the hopeless. That is upholding justice. That is the scale of justice that we all, as his bride, as his church, are called to still yet today uphold in the time of grace and mercy, in the time of love. And as Isaiah says, if you haven't read it in the Christmas season, camp in Isaiah, because it is all about this season of Advent. But as it says in Isaiah, I desire that you would understand these things. Learn these things. Learn about justice. learn about mercy, but learn how to do it my way. I'm paraphrasing. Because in the second chapter, it talks about the learning, the understanding, and the walking it out.
So as we end this, on the selfish meter, I think we all get it. The wise men were pretty awesome. They not only reacted well, that they were way out in front of it all. And so now you bring it respectively back to us. I'm selfish. I recognize that I'm selfish, and that's where it starts. I need to recognize it. I need to get that I'm not always my wife's favorite person. And I want to be my wife's favorite person. And to be that, the key is love. And what is love? Jesus demonstrated it. It's complete self-sacrificial. If you want to know if you're loving, just check yourself on the meter. That'll give you the answer.
As we transition from the word about selfishness and its motivating factor of fear, and the call, the movement, the invitation into selflessness and love, I'm going to read the words that were on that video for us to contemplate. So here we go. Expecting me, I'm making my way, leaving everything I've known for solidarity to be with you. No vacancy, can you make room? Like Mary, open your womb. Give me refuge. Make living space within. I am growing a body, one progressive mind, one beating heart for creation kind. Two arms to carry my love, shoulders to bear it, and legs that will walk me to the end. It's believed that it takes a divine act, an angelic messenger or miracle, an unwinding string of unbelievable yet real circumstances to convince and inspire real world change. This is true. And yet, willing souls also make a difference. People courageous enough to resist death dealing, starve fear, and consecrate space for holiness. Life begetting life. New breath. Fresh eyes. Hope. This kind of resistance calls you with me to offer dignity. House the refugee. Grace the infringed, the exiled, the homeless, the stranger. To become the innkeeper, allowing just one more family, without reservation, his last bit of room, just enough for me. Light embodied, grow with me, expand. Breathe deep. Welcome. Make room. There is more than enough. I am, after all, for every last one of you. Lead one another by my way, leaving everything you've known for solidarity to be with me. Open your eyes. I'm expecting you. Make room, beloved. There is more than enough. May the Lord bless you and keep you throughout this week and in the Christmas season. May you be challenged to see those that are on the margins, on the fringe, those requiring community. And may you hear his whisper to open up and let them in.